I'm Lauren Sega, Manager of Communications for Homeport, a nonprofit affordable housing developer in Central Ohio. We're in one of the fastest growing areas in the country, and while we've seen the growth, we've felt the pains that come along with it, especially when it comes to housing all of us and our incoming neighbors. Each month, we're interviewing local experts on the issues, the barriers, and the solutions around housing and development, hoping to shed some light on how we got where we are and what we can do to create a future that houses everyone. This is Level With Us. Today, we're joined by Aaron Prosser, Deputy Director of Housing Strategies for the City of Columbus, and we talk all things zoning. In early April, the city released some proposed changes to its 1950s-era zoning code, so-called Phase 1, aimed at enabling redevelopment of our urban core, those areas in downtown and surrounding neighborhoods, specifically our larger transportation corridors. The code would allow for higher densities, reuse of older buildings, and construction of taller buildings for housing, offices, and retail on empty parcels and parking lots. All told, an estimated 88,000 units could potentially come out of this, a big chunk of the 200,000 the city says we need to keep up with our growing population.
Our zoning code was artificially restricting our ability to build a lot of housing. By Phase 1 focusing on the corridors, I think that really helps drive not just the density to the proper location, but it helps us leverage it to get things like more robust transit, support our small businesses, all the things that'll happen along these corridors when you just have more people. You know, one of the jokes I make about Columbus is that if we were looking at our growth right now, we're probably in about middle school. We've had a little bit of growth, but we're not quite comfortable with it, and we don't quite have all the skills we need to accommodate it.
Right.
And so we're in this space where we're about to become a big kid city, but we don't quite have all our pieces in place. Mm-hmm. And I think there is this conversation around the chicken or the egg, right? Does transit come first or does housing come first? And how do we balance both of those pieces? And I think what you see with the zone-in and then coupled with Link Us, which we'll see hopefully on the ballot this November, hopefully doing those things in conjunction with each other, everything will line up on different corridors in different ways, but certainly allowing us to add the densities to support transit is meaningful. And then having affordability accessible to that transit line, mm-hmm. so that we're not pricing people out of that opportunity just because of the incomes that they have. And so how deliberate can we be? And as we look at the zoning code update, we've added in a height bonus, where along those corridors, if you're looking to build up to a certain level, you have that right under the new zoning code. If you want to go higher, we're going to allow that, but then we're going to require that you do affordability in conjunction with that.
Right.
And so that gets us, again, coupling access to transit, making sure that regardless of what you do for a living and what your income is in Columbus, that if you want to live along a transit corridor and access that transportation option, you should be allowed to do that, and you should be able to afford to do that.
As the region prepares for unforeseen growth over the next 15 to 25 years, multiple efforts are moving forward at once to efficiently house and move our soon-to-be 3 million residents. Along with rezoning, one of these efforts is Link Us, a regional initiative to expand transportation options. Link Us plans include Franklin and portions of other counties, including Delaware, Fairfield, Licking, and Union. The purpose of Link Us is to integrate various modes of transportation to connect jobs to affordable housing, manage traffic congestion as more people settle here, reduce urban sprawl, and lower our greenhouse gas emissions. This is to be achieved through more robust bus rapid transit corridors and greater investment in sidewalks, trails, and bike infrastructure. The $8 billion effort is being brought before voters this November. We can look at the proposed Capital Line downtown, a 2-mile bike and pedestrian pathway, as a kind of urban planning that would be possible in more areas with Zone In and Link Us working in tandem.
As we look at downtown and the Capitol Trail, and again, giving just that kind of lifeline to the downtown, where we've historically been a place that, you know, the minute we called it Central Business Districts instead of a downtown neighborhood is when we sort of lost the thread of it being a place.
Yeah.
And having sort of these sort of great parts of living in a city, and the Capitol Trail will help us build out those kinds of amenities and balance out the cars, right? There'll still be vehicle access, mm-hmm. but how do we do it in a way that's more responsive to other modes of transportation? How do we balance it against the need to protect pedestrians, to make it more walkable, to make the businesses more successful because the street feels more comfortable? Those are all things that, as we think about not focusing on cars, we have to accommodate them. That's part of the fabric of how our communities are built. But one of the things I always look back on, you know, back when car manufacturers first started getting in the business, and they were having some trouble selling cars, because quite honestly, it wasn't very efficient to drive a car. Mm-hmm. You would go on the road, and there would be pedestrians and horses and bicycles and all this stuff in the roadway that made it just, quite honestly, time-consuming and difficult to drive. Mm-hmm. So a lot of folks weren't interested in it. And so the car manufacturers then went out to municipalities with lobbyists, and they pitched jaywalking laws. And they went out to these cities and they said, you, for safety, really need to think about just really getting everyone else out of the roadways and making it a criminal offense, right? We look at jaywalking now, you can get a ticket for it. And when they did that, they essentially cleared the roadways of all the other people that used what are really public spaces,
yeah.
left it just for the vehicle. Vehicles can move faster, they become efficient, they become more popular, people start buying them, and then it kind of creates the cycle that we've seen in the U.S. since then. But that was a deliberate decision just to sell cars. It wasn't a deliberate decision about how we use public space and how we use our cities. Correct. And so how do we look back and say, we want to make a better balance now. We don't want these what is really public space to solely be available for vehicles. But what else does it mean to make safe spaces for bicyclists, access to transit, walkability? All those pieces are way more a part of the conversation than they used to be.
Alongside these broader conversations about diversifying the modes of transportation, deprioritizing cars, and letting pedestrians and cyclists reclaim a part of this public space, the proposed changes to the zoning code have also built in a kind of flexibility as it relates to parking. The suburban mindset of driving to a destination and parking within 20 feet of the building will have to shift. That won't happen overnight, and there will certainly be developments along these main corridors that build in parking. But as density is added to our urban core, the way land is used must be reconsidered. Is it better to have parking or to have more housing? In 15 to 20 years, when these housing and transportation initiatives have been better built out, how many people choosing to live in our urban core will choose to have a car?
The removal of the parking requirements out of the zoning code, specifically along these corridors, is something that we've seen in other cities, mm-hmm. right? Including cities that are very much like Columbus in terms of size and you know, kind of growth trajectory. And what we see is the market delivers that parking because they understand that culturally we haven't made that shift entirely.
Right.
So what we see is where, you know, right now our code requires 1.5 spaces per bedroom or per unit. And what we understand is that's the same on Bethel Road as it is on Long Street on the Near East Side. Zoning becomes this kind of big blunt tool that isn't necessarily responsive to the place.
Right.
And what we know is the market will behave differently depending on what other amenities are available. Mm-hmm. So if a developer needs to park it at a 1.5 to 1 ratio, they can still do that. Mm-hmm. In areas where we have transit and the developer feels like they could go down to a 1-to-1 or a 0.7-to-1, those opportunities are available. Everywhere from places like Austin to Minneapolis to Buffalo, the market delivers parking. Mm-hmm. And they're going to respond to what their tenants need, what the banks require. And then what we can do and what we should do as the city is respond by how are we dealing with our public right-of-way? How are we managing our parking system in our streets and roadways along the edges? So as we think about a development coming in and, you know, it is pretty significant, and our parking team at the city takes a look and says, well, you know, we've done some analysis and there is an impact. How can we better manage our right-of-way so that the residents and the proximity, the area around it, still have the opportunity to have access to parking? That's really what the city should be focused on, and the team that we built in public service is underway with a parking strategy right now, continuing to evolve and reflect those market changes. But really making the city's focus on our rights of way and making sure that we're doing what we can do to manage our parking system and allowing the market to respond as we continue to evolve as a community.
And now it's time to level up. If you're new here or new to the issue of housing, here are some key takeaways. Presently, at our current population, we are in a housing shortage. And even as we continue to build, year over year we have fallen short of the number of homes needed to keep up with our population growth. Beyond being short about 53,000 units overall, the price points for the units we do have leave 80,000 of us Central Ohioans severely cost-burdened, spending more than half our income on housing. Even if Columbus wasn't one of the fastest-growing cities in the U.S., our current status is approaching the crisis level. As housing becomes less available, those with lower income and fewer resources also have the least amount of housing choice. This means, based on how much you make, you could be losing proximity to not just amenities, but opportunities, education, employment. With Zone In, Aaron's goal, speaking for the city, is to prevent that outcome.
So we use a couple of tools. One will be the zoning code. Greater density is going to result in a kind of a recalibration of pricing and allowing more units to happen. Will help us keep rents from escalating to the point of where we see in places like Austin and Nashville, where it's just a lot of places are just unavailable unless you make an extraordinary amount of money. But then we also use inclusionary tools. We're going to use the height bonus through the zoning code, where four of the six categories that'll be a part of the new code will allow for an increase in height as long as you are including affordable units in those buildings.
And affordable means?
So right now we are required under the Ohio Revised Code to couple this bonus program with our community reinvestment area program, our residential incentive. So there's three different categories of market conditions. In the two highest, you would have 10% of the units at 60% AMI and 10% at 80% AMI. And then in our third category, ready for opportunity, it would be 10% at 80 and 10% at 100. It's about including affordability in market rate projects where the market is driving the most activity, because the market isn't naturally going to deliver those units. And so that will be a big part of how we do that. There's also an effort through LinkUS to look at what we call equitable transit-oriented development. Where are we looking around the station locations so that we can start to think about how do we intentionally build in affordability so that the access to transit is not just for folks making a certain income. But if you are a social worker in our community, if you're a student in our community, you can decide you would like to live along the transit corridor and find a place that's affordable to you. And so as we make those investments, we want to make sure that we're also coupling that with the affordability where we can.
AMI stands for Area Median Income, and for Central Ohio, our AMI sits around $63,000. So the units created out of this affordability bonus would serve folks making between $37,800 to about $63,000 annually. That is a big chunk of the population that is currently underserved, but this bonus doesn't really address the growing number of folks in the extremely low income bracket, those making $18,000 a year or less, who are severely housing cost burdened or unhoused altogether. For that bracket, it's going to take a lot more than rezoning to provide adequate housing.
It's about the system and it's about our investment. So when we look at the range of apartments that are in our community today, we have a lot of apartments kind of in the middle brackets of affordability for different income levels. Very few units for those making below $18,000 a year, but equal very few units for folks making above $72,000 a year. So the people making above $72,000 are not at risk for falling into homelessness. They're just going to go down the ladder, right? They're just going to go into the next space, and they're going to rent the apartment or buy the house right below them. That pressure on the system goes straight down to the folks who are earning the least in our community and then who are the most vulnerable. And so we need to alleviate the pressure on the system by building market rate projects. We need to invest in kind of the central portion of the income brackets where we have a lot of the workforce here in Central Ohio. But then we have to be very focused and deliberate about how we focus on our most vulnerable. And that takes public subsidy. That is not something the market can ever deliver just based on an incentive. They cannot deliver that housing given the current cost of construction without a deep subsidy from the public side, both in construction, but also in ongoing rent subsidy. So you have to couple those both together, and how do we look at families and understand how do we get them housing stable depending on where they're coming from on an income level. If you're on Social Security, it will be very difficult to afford housing in Central Ohio. So what does it look like to invest in permanent supportive housing? What does it look like to invest in senior housing? How do we build out those spaces so that folks that either need temporary or permanent support to maintain their housing, they have it, so that we can make them sustainable long-term in the community? And we're looking at different opportunities around some of our high-performing nonprofits that might address a specific issue that a family's facing. So we think about women and children coming out of domestic violence situations. They may need support for 12, 18, 24 months to restabilize their lives and get them to a place where they can be housing sustainable. That is partially around their income, but it's partially around just kind of dealing with some of the things that they're going to deal with specifically around the issue that's facing them. So how do we couple that with nonprofits that really know what they're doing? And I think really looking at populations to understand what is their barrier to stabilizing their housing, and how do we couple that with wraparound services that meet their specific needs, is really hard work.
We've discussed on the pod before about how a right to housing framework could not just lift thousands of families out of housing instability, but could bring more people into the workforce, graduate more kids from high school and college, and improve the health of our community overall. We dive a bit deeper into the topic in episode 1, level setting, and the subsequent bonusode. Housing is foundational to a number of interweaving issues like public safety and public health, because if you don't have stable housing, you're not future thinking. You're not saving for your kids' education or for your own retirement. You're in survival mode. The same is true, to a slightly lesser extent, if your housing costs burdened.
That level of housing stress that is on so many families, so the minute we start to see rents and home prices rise, you're going to make a series of decisions. And we see families making them. The first decision is you're going to move out and away. So this is what we call drive till you qualify. And this is where we build housing very far out. And at some point, you can drive 60 minutes and you're going to be able to rent an apartment. It's not going to be anywhere close to your job. You're going to lose 2 hours a day with your kids. You're not going to be able to participate in civic organizations because you don't have time. All those things happen when you have to make that kind of a commute. But if you don't want to pay more than 30%, at some point, you have to keep moving outward. The second piece that people are going to do is decide, quite honestly, to be housing cost burdened. If you want to send your kids to a particular school, but you don't have the income to meet that rent, you might push it, right? And you might decide, I'm going to push it. When we look at the maps of Central Ohio where we see rent-burdened families, it's in places of high opportunity because we suspect those families are deciding, I want to be close to this opportunity for my kids or for myself. That's important to me, so I'm going to stretch my rental budget in order to do that.
And make sacrifices elsewhere.
Correct. I'm going to have less high quality child care. I'm going to have a less reliable car. Those are all compromises that they're going to start to make.
Yeah.
And then the third is where you're going to start to have a less stable situation, where you're going to need to double up with your sister's family for a period of time. You might make some decisions about kind of having temporary housing if you can make it to the next piece, and you start to make sort of this really unstable circumstance for you and your family, which a lot of times we'll end up in crisis. Mm-hmm. And as we look across, how do we, again, stabilize families so that we don't have this kind of pressure and on the family to end up in crisis? How do we make sure that if you, and this was true of Central Ohio 10 years ago. You look at 2010 Central Ohio, there was a lot of choice and you could make a lot of decisions. When we look at Central Ohio today, if you have any challenges on your background, you have a felony, you have an eviction. Right now, quite honestly, if you have kids, you're a less attractive renter. Landlords are now getting to kind of cherry pick. Maybe not intentionally, but certainly that's how it shakes out. And if you can have a couple with no kids or a couple with kids, and you might think about, oh gosh, you know, there might be, you know, kids might damage things, and I don't want to mess with that, so I'm going to rent to this other couple. So those things that are now on your background or in your family circumstance is going to push you into less and less stable housing, and where we get the exploitation of families, where we see things like Colonial Village and Latitude 525, where these families had 10 years ago other options to put roof over their head and they didn't have to sit in these conditions, but because the market is so constrained, they're stuck in that space.
Yeah.
And they're stuck having to deal with the substandard conditions because there's nowhere else for them to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes a challenge for us around enforcement and how we deal with it, because how do we relocate those families? And so it is this constant tension of trying to figure out how to manage those spaces, and that's really born out of the constraints. And so I think we would like a future where you have choice and your housing is safe and stable, and if you would like, you can enter into home ownership and start wealth building. That's an increasingly big challenge for most families, certainly young people. Getting into that home ownership space is prohibitively expensive right now. And so if it's our primary wealth building vehicle, what does that look like for the next generation? What does that look like for your ability to send your kids to college, right? A lot of folks rely on the equity in their house for their retirements. Those things are all coming down the pike if we can't get people into home ownership. And that's just the primary wealth building vehicle in the U.S., and that is what it is. We have to be focused on how do we make sure, if that is of interest to you, that you have the opportunity to do that.
Again, zoning is just one piece of this. More is needed to tackle the other barriers to building more housing, including workforce shortages, building costs, and there will have to be a mindset shift. As with a lot of change, people are nervous. They have questions, concerns. Sense of place is a defining factor in a person's life, and the threat of that changing out of their control is a real fear that drives some of the hesitation to accept this new zoning code. The University District and the Short North are two neighborhoods that have added density and subsequently come under some scrutiny for their commercialization over the years. There's a hesitation to accept a code that might similarly transform other Columbus neighborhoods, a concern for preserving small businesses and quote-unquote neighborhood character.
What we all have to understand is change is coming.
Yeah.
Change is coming. All of our neighborhoods are going to change. Are they going to change for the better or for the worse? We have to make that decision. Everything staying the way it is today is not going to happen.
Right.
We are a city that is growing for a lot of reasons, one of which being the Ohio State University, right? We have an incredible talent pipeline that we can offer employers as they come into Columbus area. We have very little seismic activity. So a lot of, especially the tech partners, really like having buildings that don't shake mm-hmm. at any point for a lot of their uses. There's all these factors that are coalescing around people deciding that Central Ohio is a place they want to be. There isn't a commission or a board that decides who comes in and who doesn't. As those folks choose to come into our community, if we have the housing available and it's in the right locations along places like corridors, then we'll be able to accommodate these new residents. If we just decide not to build the housing to accommodate them, it doesn't mean they stop coming. What then ends up happening is we end up with sprawl. We end up eating up a lot of the farmland. We end up eating up a lot of what we consider to be really great parts of living in the city. Now, we're going to see more density along our corridors, but with that gets support for small businesses, coffee shops, transit. We have to also talk about what density gets us.
Yeah.
And when we look at I spent 11 years at Ohio State, and I was there during the point when we changed the zoning on High Street. Mm-hmm. We worked with city staff to take the by right height from 35 foot to 72 feet. What you see on High Street is a direct result of that.
Yeah.
There is criticism because they are luxury buildings. But what happens is those students that can afford those luxury buildings, they come up and they occupy those units. What we saw in the University District then was a recalibration of rents on the east side of Pearl. Mm-hmm. So students that can't afford the luxury got a better apartment for less expense because the competition had been lowered. Mm-hmm. The University District has long had housing constraints. Right, that's part of the campus landlord model. And when we allowed that new construction to happen along High Street, you suddenly saw responsiveness in rents and also responsiveness in investment in the units. So what you end up seeing is people getting what they're paying for. Now, not everyone can afford the luxury units on High Street. A bunch of people do. Happy to have them move in there because it lowers that competition east of Pearl. For the buildings that may be 10, 15, 20, 25 years old, those are going to be now affordable to the college students that are at Ohio State. And I think that's what we see in the Short North and in other places. If we can drive that density to a place that can accommodate it well, it relieves the pressure on our neighborhoods and actually helps us maintain some of the neighborhood character that we think is really meaningful.
Yeah.
But it's going to take allowing that density to happen on our corridors.
And now we break for a side quest. Did you grow up around here?
I did. I grew up in actually a township. I did. I grew up in Perry Township, which is on 315 North. Up, I attended Worthington Schools. My parents, and actually, my dad was an Army brat, and so when he was in sales, so they moved around a lot before we were born, my brother and sister and I. And my dad said, you know, wherever they go to kindergarten, they're going to stay for the 12 years, because he didn't like that experience as a kid of changing schools a lot and
being a new kid.
Right, he went to 4 different high schools his freshman year. Like, that was not a great, he didn't enjoy that experience. So he said, wherever they go to kindergarten, they're going to graduate. And it just so happened we were in Columbus.
Wow. Why did you raise your hand to fill your position?
It's been a really interesting experience. I started my career at Franklin County. I'm a city planner by background, and had the opportunity to go to Franklin County. And at the time, we were just kind of starting the Big Darby conversations on the west side. Mm. And everybody understood that if they developed the way they had historically developed, there were going to be impacts to the Darby waterway. Mm. And the Darby is the most pristine waterway east of the Mississippi. It's really species diverse. It's a really important part of our ecosystem. So my early experience around housing was honestly trying to limit it and going out to community meetings and people being really upset that we were even speaking about limiting housing.
Right.
And so what we were going on saying is like, ooh, you know, these mussels in this creek are really more important than the livelihood of your family. And it didn't go very well.
Yeah.
And you think that was 20 years ago. Fast forward to today, where we have this incredible opposition to housing and to building new housing. That is a very recent component.
Hmm.
You know, the idea of NIMBYs, as we call them today, which isn't a word I particularly like, but that was really, you know, 20 years ago, really only for kind of noxious uses. And you had communities that would come around and coalesce around, you know, industrial uses or, you know, change to big commercial uses. That was really where that advocacy happened. And somehow over the last 20 years, we've become, a lot of parts of our community become anti-housing. And how did that happen? And how do we change the conversation? And, you know, in the intervening years between being at the county and being here, you know, I had the chance to go through the work with the neighborhood in Wineland Park, where it was really ahead of its time in terms of the housing crunch and what was happening in that neighborhood. We were able to go in and we knew, I don't think we knew how crazy, but we understood that it, given its location between Ohio State and the Short North, housing prices were going to rise there once we kind of addressed some of the structural issues around public safety. So as the folks are working through the public safety issues, we're stabilizing a large portfolio of project-based Section 8. We spent a bunch of years pushing in as much affordability as we could, because we knew we had just a small window.
Mm-hmm.
And we could go in and we used low-income housing tax credits, we used NSP, and we used every tool we could grab, right? And we built as much housing as we could, ending up with about 500 units of protected affordability in a relatively small neighborhood. And I remember we would regularly renovate houses and then put them on the market. And up until 2017, we lost money on them.
Mm.
So that was just a few years ago. It's not like it was that long ago.
Right.
2017, I remember we made money on the sale of the house. And we were all like, okay. Here we go. And the market has responded, right? And what we have in that neighborhood is really a lot. So 60% of the residents in Wineland Park still live below the poverty level.
Mm-hmm.
It looks gentrified, right? It wears that badge sometimes because it's really nice. We built really nice affordable housing because we think that's important. And that's what Homeport does. It's what all of our partners do now, to the point where you don't probably even know it's affordable housing.
Right.
So we built this neighborhood out. We secured all this affordability. The market took off, and you know, we have residents living in low-income housing tax credit projects that literally share an alley with $600,000 homeowners.
Right.
And that is about economic inclusivity. That is about access to opportunities at Ohio State and downtown, and making sure that those families had that opportunity was not a short amount of work. Mm-hmm. And the market would never have happened. You can look just south of Fifth Avenue in Italian Village, and you know happens without any care and intervention. So how do we? So that is the work that was deeply meaningful to me. And when the city said, would you like to do it at the city level? I was like, yes, I would. It just is too great an opportunity. We have elected officials. My counterparts in other cities fight with their elected officials. Not my problem. Our elected officials understand the crisis. They understand we need to act. They understand what we need to do. And we're all rowing in the same direction. And it's an incredible opportunity to think about how we in Central Ohio could literally be the city that gets it right.
Yeah.
I can look around. There's pieces and parts where I'm like, oh, you know, Minneapolis did great work on the corridors. Our Sunbelt cities are doing great job on supply, but they're kind of sprawling. How do we take all those pieces and parts and think about the future for Central Ohio and for Columbus? And it's too big of an opportunity not to have engaged in.
If you want to share feedback or ask some questions about the proposed zoning code changes, you can still visit the Zone-In Gallery at 141 North Front Street. It's open 6 days a week during the proposal's public comment period, April 9th to June 7th. You can sign up for a public tour or schedule a one-on-one consultation. I'll link the Zone-In website in the show notes. Level With Us is brought to you by Homeport and is recorded, mixed, and edited by Lauren Sega. All sources are in the show notes. Homeport creates strong communities by developing quality, affordable homes on a cornerstone of dignity, security, and opportunity. To learn more, or if you'd like to support our mission, visit us at homeportohio.org.